So we're reading from Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita today, Madhya Leela, Chapter 5, The Activities of Sakshi Gopal. Today is text 33 to 45. So this is the continuation of the pastime of the Sakshi Gopal story. And we are with the two brahmanas, a young brahmana and an elderly brahmana. And some special events are going to happen. So text 33. Then the younger brahmana addressed the deity, saying, "My dear Lord, you are my witness. I shall call for you to testify if it is necessary later on." Now, of course, maybe a little background. There's the older brahmana who had a daughter, offered her daughter to the younger brahmana in reciprocation of the excellent service he had rendered to him. However, the younger brahmana was somewhat concerned that this wasn't really a suitable match given the different social statuses. And so he asked the elder brahmana to come before the deity and make the promise in front of the deity. So this is what is happening today. This young brahmana is addressing the deity and he says, "My dear Lord, you are my witness. I shall call for you to testify if it is necessary later on." Text 34. After these talks, the two brahmanas started for home. As usual, the young brahmana accompanied the elderly brahmana as if the older brahmana were a guru, spiritual master, and rendered him service in various ways. After returning to Vidyanagar, each brahmana went to his respective home. After some time, the elderly brahmana became very anxious. He began to think, "I have given my word to a brahmana in a holy place, and what I promised will certainly come to pass. I must now disclose this to my wife, sons, other relatives and friends." Thus, one day, the elderly brahmana called for a meeting of all his relatives and friends, and before them all, he narrated what had taken place in front of Gopal. When those who belonged to the family circle heard the narration of the old brahmana, they made exclamations showing their disappointment. They all requested that he not make such a promise, such a proposal again. They unanimously agreed, "If you offer your daughter to a degraded family, your aristocracy will be lost. When people hear of this, they will make jokes and laugh at you." The elderly brahmana said, "How can I undo the promise I made in a holy place while on pilgrimage? Whatever may happen, I must give him my daughter in charity." The relatives unanimously said, "If you give your daughter to that boy, we shall give up all connection with you." Indeed, his wife and sons declared, "If such a thing happens, we shall take poison and die." The elderly brahmana said, "If I do not give my daughter to the young brahmana, he will call Sri Gopalji as a witness. Thus he will take my daughter by force, and in that case my religious principles will become meaningless." Text 43. His son replied, "The deity may be a witness, but he is in a distant country. How can he come to bear witness against you? Why are you so anxious over this? You do not have to flatly deny that you spoke such a thing. There is no need to make a false statement. Simply say that you do not remember what you said." That brings us to today's verse, text 45. Translation by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. "If you simply say, 'I do not remember, I shall take care of the rest. By argument, I shall defeat the young brahmana.'" Purport. The son of the elderly brahmana was an atheist and a follower of the Raghunath Smriti. He was very expert in dealing with pound, shillings, pence, but he was fool number one. Consequently, he did not believe in the spiritual position of the deity, nor did he have any faith in the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, as a typical idol worshipper, he considered the form of the Lord to be made of stone or wood. Thus he assured his father that the witness was only a stone deity and was not capable of speaking. Besides that, he assured his father that the deity was situated far away and consequently could not come to bear witness. In essence, he was saying, have no anxiety. You do not have to lie directly, but you should speak like a diplomat, like King Yudhishthir when he spoke to Dronacharya, Ashwatthama hata I gaja. Following this principle, simply say that you do not remember anything and are completely unaware of the statements given by the younger Brahmana. If you make the background like that, I shall know how to fill in the argument and defeat him by word jugglery. Thus, I shall save you from having to give your daughter to him. In this way, our aristocracy will be saved. You have nothing to worry about. Srila Prabhupada ki. Om Gyanati Miranasya Gyananjana Shalakya Shakshuran Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namah Om Shri. So a very interesting pastime. The younger Brahmana knew this was going to happen. It was clear to him that this was a highly irregular arrangement and that therefore there was inevitably going to be conflict once this Brahmana goes back home. Because as we all know, the family members do not necessarily always follow the lead of the father. They all have their own ideas, their own agendas. And as we find out in today's verse, their level of advancement is also not the same. Despite this being a great saintly Brahmana, who's going on pilgrimage and pure activities of traveling, seeing the deity, engaged in bhajan, it says the son of this Brahmana was an atheist. And he was expert in dealing with pounds, shillings, pence, but he was fool number one, Prabhupada says. Quite a direct statement. Despite the fact that he's the son of the Brahmana, his interest is pounds, shillings, pence, and he is fool number one. And therefore he doesn't really have much faith in the deity. So this is sadly a regular occurrence in Kali Yuga. In the past there have been many, many great saintly Brahmana families. And ideally the persons born in those families would be also trained up to be Brahmanas and would be very competent and qualified. But sadly there is always those who never really accept the spirit of it. They may know the rituals, they may learn the rituals, they may even do various detailed things, but they seem to sometimes miss the point completely. So it is a symptom, a situation which becomes increasingly worse in Kali Yuga. We don't know at which time this incident exactly took place, but it was a long time ago, sometime after Vajranabha installing the deity and sometime before Lord Chaitanya's time. So some say it's sort of roughly around the year just before Christ, as it were, just before the calendar resets from zero, roughly around that time. But we don't really know exactly. But still within the area of Kali Yuga. And definitely there's a degradation of Brahmanas continuing with great strength. In fact, the traditional Brahmana families now have adopted activities, lifestyles, which are hardly Brahminical. Sometimes they've done so out of necessity due to the world changing in ways that no longer supports Brahmins, really. But on most occasions, it is probably due to them being bewildered by lust, anger, greed, wealth, power, prestige, which they see others acquiring, but they themselves don't have it. Now, in the past, of course, you had great Brahmanas, and it would not be a great of great concern that they have wealth, etc. That's why typically Brahmanas would be poor. Not all Brahmanas. Clearly the Brahmanas in the courts of the kings were not poor. They were not required to be poverty-stricken like Sudama Vipra. But if that was the situation that was offered by the Supreme Lord, then they would conduct themselves on that basis. They would live by different means, either by performing yajñas, which is the role of brahmanas, by performing yajña sacrifice on behalf of members of society, and they would be rewarded for that, or they would collect alms by begging, in some cases, or in some cases it's even authorized that if circumstances are really bad, then a brahmana can start to adopt a profession of the slightly lower orders, kshatriya and vaishya. Now, this is obviously an emergency stipulation. It's not it's not supposed to be a general recommendation. Brahmanas are supposed to be quite satisfied with whatever. Now, that also requires a situation which supports that kind of lifestyle. And in some countries, it's possible more than in others. In India, if there is a poor person, a brahmana, they can quite happily subsist. They can quite happily live. They'll put up with a lot of austerity. Simple features of Mother Nature are still available. There's water in the rivers, there are trees for shade, for rest, depending on the person's level. And a person can subsist. It becomes a lot more difficult in the West and in other countries, where a certain minimum facility is almost required just to survive. I mean, it's quite difficult for someone to survive when the temperature gets to zero. only a great yogi, the types who would live in the Himalayas, you know, they may have such physical abilities. Or as some other devotees have explained, as Kali Yuga progresses, our bodily construction also decreases to the extent that what we are capable of tolerating also becomes increasingly minimized as time goes on. So in many places, one needs a certain basic facility, a house, shelter, then finance, because you simply can't do anything without finance in some places. There's almost nothing you can do. You can beg, but then that itself has consequences, because there will be people who will disturb you from begging. They will see it as an eyesore and they will try to move you along. So it is actually very difficult to even try to practice being a poor person. In some places, it's not even allowed. Which is nice, actually, in one sense, that the state wants to make sure that no one has to needlessly suffer, which is fine. But it sometimes can compromise what a brahmana needs to do in order for them to survive as a brahmana. Because then the bare minimum is not sufficient, and one needs more. One needs more and more, and then one has to deal with the expectations not only of their own needs, but of all the others. Their dependence. And that often creates a lot of additional stress and anxiety. A simple brahmana is probably quite happy with a simple austere life. But when there is a wife, there's children, and they have to be educated, they have so many demands, they have to live within the society, then it becomes a complex situation. So, therefore you have, even here in this case, you have this elderly brahmana who was more well-to-do, from a higher sort of material status, and then you have the other brahmana who is just a poor, simple brahmana. So it is interesting how you have these different types of situations. And what's interesting is that both brahmanas were equally focused on the Supreme Lord. And the younger one served the older one as a guru, to take care of him out of a natural affection, a natural sense of duty of serving someone who is older. When, as people get older, you know, the body produces all sorts of difficulties. Simple things become more difficult. Collecting water, taking rest, even getting up at a certain point becomes difficult. So then it is the natural order of things that the younger persons should provide assistance to such older people. It is actually a basis of our culture. It is traditional culture that different people are protected. We know the five categories of living entities that should be protected, right? We know, first of all women should be protected. As Prabhupada repeatedly says throughout his books, women should be protected. Then cows are supposed to be protected. Brahmanas, old men and children. So these are categories of persons who deserve and are entitled to protection. And so any civilized society is supposed to make sure that these persons are protected nicely. So for devotees also, as devotees get older, it is almost a duty that we look after those who are getting older. Now, the duty is also reciprocal, in that those who are being looked after also have to be acting as the older Brahmana here. That they have to be fully focused on the Supreme Lord. When there is an advanced senior person, now as one gets older, the body falls apart, and typically the mind starts to weaken as well. That is natural, that is normal, no one can do anything about that. But what someone can do about is their strength of spiritual practice. And a junior spiritual seeker will very happily, with great satisfaction, serve an older senior person who is demonstrating an advanced level of Krishna consciousness, or even an advanced level of practice of Krishna consciousness. So that becomes a simple duty for older people, that if they act as examples, yad acharati shreshtas, whatever a great man does, common men follow. Whatever a senior person does, a junior person should follow. Whatever an older person does, a younger person should follow. If this system is there, where the older devotees actually act and demonstrate very good qualities, just as this older Brahmana is doing, then the younger devotees will be more than happy to serve them. And if they do not serve them, that is a dereliction of duty. It is perhaps one of the ways that they are avoiding making advancement. Because Krishna is sending someone who should be looked after, should be assisted. And if we fail to do that, that is a problem. So you see now how, despite the two Brahmanas being very nice, very saintly, very pakka, you could say, the family members are propagating principles and calling them dharma when they're not actually dharma. There are many false things that have been mentioned by this person. The first false thing is that he's referring to his aristocracy and how it will be damaged by giving the daughter to this young Brahmana, who is a very saintly person. Aristocracy is never damaged by adopting something more saintly. So this is the twisted understanding of what is advanced. Here they're thinking that now, if the girl is given to a poor Brahmana, her level of sense gratification will be reduced. Her level of interaction with her former friends, with her former family, will be reduced because they will no longer do the standard enjoyment, sense gratificatory activities. They'll be in a different social class where they'll have their own different activities. So just consider the basis upon which he is rejecting. His basis is entirely false. As a Brahmana, he has been degraded and he's following something, a life based on sense gratification. He doesn't even have faith in the deity. Yet he is seeking to pass comment on what is higher and what is lower, what is degraded and what is advanced. That is Kali Yuga summed up. A highly disqualified person who themselves does not follow either the words of Lord Krishna or has faith in Lord Krishna, or follows the words of the devotees, you know, as they come down in line from Krishna, maybe our founder Acharya. They may look at Prabhupada's words, they may look at the books, read the books, and then propagate something which is in direct contrast to what Prabhupada propagates. And they may even coerce many other people into accepting that stance, which is exactly what this person is trying to do. The whole family has come together, and they've all made their speeches, declaring how abominable it is that this thing should happen. But all of those speeches are based upon falsity. The fundamental principle is false. Someone has decided to do something based upon the modern trend. And here the modern trend is clearly atheism. The Brahminical principles are not so important. The modern trend here is atheism. See the deity as a stone object, something to use for our sustenance, something to acknowledge from time to time. Go to the temple from time to time, once a year, more than sufficient. See the deity, maybe even offer something, put something in the donation box. That's good. But it's not meant to be a once-a-year activity. And the Supreme Lord is the Supreme Lord at all times. So a person who understands that the Supreme Lord has an unquestionable, unchallenged position that does not change according to the whims of the world and does not change as times change, needs to be served in a certain way, which is also consistent and in accordance with dharma. So when we hear these types of pastimes, hopefully we can be reminded just how dangerous this path of spiritual life is. Even if we at a certain point become very much committed to Krishna consciousness, very much committed to worshipping the Lord, worshipping the deity, performing Sankirtan, doing different activities for the pleasure of the Lord, there is a tendency for us to eventually, at some point, see the Lord as stone or wood. To see the Lord as just someone who's there. He's kind of just there. He's part of the fittings. He's part of the furniture. You come to the temple room, you see the walls, you see the pictures, you see the Lord. He's there. A standard constant factor. So that is a dangerous, but something that will probably come to everyone at some point. It is a type of mentality that will, it won't just manifest one morning. You wake up and you think like this. It'll happen gradually over a period of time. The level of respect, the level of reverence that we offer to the deity will decrease little by little by little. And then we may be at this level at some point. So Prabhupada said one interesting thing regarding deities. He was speaking about how one should treat the deities. And he said, if our chanting and reading, hearing does not take place in a very strong manner, then eventually we may see that the deities are a great burden that my spiritual master has left me. What a great burden my spiritual master has left. And it becomes an item of resentment that somehow we have to scrabble together and, okay, if it's a little too difficult to offer this thing to the Lord, which is according to the standard, let's just reduce it. Let's just remove something because it's more convenient. After all, Prabhupada said, Harinam Sankirtan is the most important thing in this world. He even said, shut the temple and go out and preach on one occasion in one place. Let's try it here because the worship of the Lord is becoming more difficult. So that's where it can go. We can all see that that's very easily a direction things could go. Now, we've all had a little challenge thrown at us in terms of coronavirus. Many of the devotees who would be traditionally engaged in pujari service are not allowed to, sadly. Krishna is missing out on a lot of service. And so there is always a tendency to try to reduce something. So it always requires a very careful balancing, a careful, focused attention. Are we doing something for our convenience? Or could something actually be done? Could something more actually be done, just with a little more effort on our side? That is always a question. And the answer will be different in all circumstances. So I'm not going to give an answer. Because in spiritual life and in life in general, nothing is black and white, nothing is concrete. Dharma itself is not a static concept. Now here, there is a mention made of the Mahabharata story, Ashwatthama Hata I Gaja. This one occasion when Yudhishthira Maharaj was enticed to say a lie. Now he had to lie, he had to say Ashwatthama is dead. Because his spiritual teacher had said that I will only stop fighting when I hear something unpleasant. Otherwise you cannot kill me under any circumstances. You simply cannot do it because I am far too powerful. And he was. But he said, yes, the only way I can be killed is if I hear something unpleasant. And so Krishna at the right time wanted to say Ashwatthama is dead. This is Dronacharya, of course, Ashwatthama, his son. And Yudhishthira Maharaj didn't want to do it. Didn't want to do it. He said, Ashwatthama is not dead. How can I say this? Krishna was enticing him to say an untruth. And Yudhishthira is the Dharma Raj, right? He's the son of Dharma himself, and his conduct is entirely impeccable. Even though, of course, there's always a group of people who would like to cast him as being somewhat adharmic. And they have a whole list of things. They have a whole list of reasons why Karna is a saint, and a whole list of reasons why Yudhishthira is not a saint. Such is Kali Yuga. Such are the arguments put forward in Kali Yuga. So Krishna was enticing Yudhishthira Maharaj to say this. And he didn't want to. So Krishna told his willing and ready, unquestioned servant, Arjun, kill this elephant, Ashwatthama, who's also called Ashwatthama. So this elephant was killed. And Yudhishthir, and then he said, tell him, this elephant is dead. So Yudhishthir said, Ashwatthama is dead. And he was referring to the elephant, who was called Ashwatthama. So indirectly, he spoke a lie. From his perspective, he spoke the truth. Because he was just relating, from his point of view, the elephant. But actually, what was wanted by Krishna that the party Dronacharya would hear is that his son was dead. So that is an interesting example that's given here. And so there are times, according to Dharma, when a falsehood or a lie is endorsed. But now who is doing that endorsement here? Krishna. Krishna is the one who is endorsing this, not his devotee. Yudhishthira isn't endorsing it. He's trying to avoid it. Now that itself is a different matter, but at least his nature is so saintly, so pure, that he does not want to lie. But Krishna himself is telling him. And Krishna is the supreme source of all dharma. Dharma means to serve Krishna. Dharma means something which pleases Krishna. Dharma means to act in accordance with the Lord's desires. There are so many different categories of dharma. There is the ultimate dharma of the Supreme Lord, then there are various sub-religious principles, different types of dharma for different castes, different social orders, different ashrams. There are different dharmas. Different dharmas for ladies, different dharmas for different types of men. There's enough dharma if you want to study that. There's enough dharma to make your mind completely bewildered in our scriptures. Different scriptures give so many details, Manusmriti, so many other places. And we would literally be bewildered. But ultimately, the highest dharma is that which comes from Krishna. Sarva dharman parityaja. Give up all lower dharmas, Krishna says. Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda ki jai. Sarva dharman parityaja mame kam sharanam braja. Aham tvam sarva pape bhyo mokshay shami masuchaha. Give up all varieties of religion and just surrender unto me, Krishna says. I will protect you from all types of difficulties. Krishna is very special. And it is rare. It is rare that one needs to compromise standard dharmas of truthful dealings in order to serve the Lord. Now, people typically, and especially as Kali Yuga progresses, this is the last leg of religion, truthfulness. And it is being hacked away progressively. For some people, their day-to-day conduct is that I will use the truth only if it serves my agenda. The truth itself is not of particular importance. As long as it allows me to achieve the outcome that I desire, I will use it. And where it becomes inconvenient, I will neglect it. So I'm sure we've all had experiences of that. Some people are more blatant in doing that than others. Some will shamelessly lie. With no shame at all, they will just say a lie. Others feel some sort of reservation that they're about to say a lie. So they try to cast their lie into pleasant-sounding words. This is kind of what the son of this older brahmana is doing. He's saying, you don't need to exactly lie. You know, he says, what does he say exactly? He says, yes, you do not have to flatly deny that you spoke such a thing. There is no need to make a false statement. Simply say that you do not remember what you said. This is the entrance of diplomacy, the scourge of Brahminical principles. The two are completely contradictory. Diplomacy is not considered very advantageous for spiritual life, according to our acharyas. Sometimes diplomacy is promoted as something highly desirable. But it is a very dangerous path. For someone who is very, very truthful and following Brahminical principles, diplomacy is really something only to be used in an absolute emergency and against your enemies. It's not meant to be a commonplace, routine activity. It includes elements of untruthfulness. Essentially, you try to portray something and recast it in a manner which seems like something which it isn't. So if someone asks you to do something, and this is quite a common one, someone asks you to do something, and you don't have any intention of doing it, for various reasons. There might be genuine reasons. You know, you might be too busy, or you might have too many other things, or it might compromise something, or it might do something. So a non-diplomat will typically just say, no, I'm not going to do it. Now, the person who hears that is not going to be impressed. They won't be impressed. They'll say, well, you're not going to do what I want you to do. Whereas a diplomat will conduct themselves slightly differently. They will make out that they're going to do it. They will say some pleasant words that pacify the person who's asking them the question. They will say something that kind of makes them feel good about themselves. And say, yes, Prabhu, I think it's a very good idea. Yes, let me think about it. Maybe we can do this, maybe we can do this, maybe we can try this. The end result is that that person doesn't do the job. The person on the receiving end feels happier with the second category of person than the first one. Why? Because it's Kali Yuga. If it was a Brahmana on the receiving end, to start with, a Brahmana is motivated by having a clear statement of facts. So a Brahmana prefers far more that the person says directly, I can't do this, and then gives some valid reasons also, rather than someone who tries to do some diplomacy and claim, yes, I'm going to do this, I'm going to meet your request, I'm going to follow your demands, but they still don't do it. They do whatever they want to do. So a Brahmana will not be happy with such dealings, whereas someone else will be. And they will promote those dealings as being higher than straightforward, truthful speech. That is a problem for someone on the Brahminical path. If someone is on another path, pound, shillings, pence, using situations to manipulate, manipulating situations, manipulating words, manipulating the truth to achieve their agenda, they will obviously promote that second category of person because they feel such a person will be more effective, will produce better results that serve their line of thinking. Now, the person here, this son of this old Brahmana, has spoken things which are highly incorrect. But he wants them to be carried out, and now he's made an elaborate plan for them to be carried out. So it is very rare in my experience that in spiritual life, when there is a genuine, straightforward, substantial service to be performed for the Lord, and the substance of that request is clear and of substance, there is almost never a need to try to use diplomacy to get someone to follow your demands. It doesn't need to happen because devotees have come to the temple, they've come to the movement to serve Krishna. So when someone knows that Krishna needs to be served in a certain way, there is very little need to ever try to twist someone, to manipulate someone, to coerce them into doing something. Some people, it might be required because they are so uncooperative, possibly. But that is the real minority. Such people tend not to hang around temples too long anyway. You know, if they're that uncooperative, they're typically uncooperative with everything in life. And so they tend to be experiencing difficulties in their normal world anyway. So typically there's no need for this kind of behavior. This kind type of behavior is only really needed when you're trying to coerce someone or a group of people into doing something that is somewhat questionable. That is the thing to bear in mind. So we have to actually understand what these correct principles are. Propaganda, which is what this person is trying to do, is not useful. Propaganda only works for individuals who are subjected to extensive material propaganda, false propaganda. So for them, as Prabhupada says, spiritual propaganda is very good. But for someone else who is focused on spiritual life, who doesn't really appreciate propaganda of any type when it comes to them and appreciates the truth, That is a better way to conduct oneself. Ultimately, truthful dealings will prevail. But sadly, I don't know if it's sadly, but somehow surprisingly, you could say, Krishna allows non-truthful dealings to continue for an extensive period of time. That is one thought that came to me the other day. It is a fact that throughout the Mahabharata, throughout life in general, people who typically conduct themselves with diplomacy, with a lack of truthfulness, typically seem to be supported and promoted by Krishna. Ultimately by Krishna. Ultimately Krishna is the one who does everything. We know that. If not directly supported or endorsed by Krishna, at least sanctioned. So I was thinking, there is this important concept. We know that not a blade of grass moves without Krishna's sanction. But at the same time, if Krishna sanctions something, it does not mean he approves of it. That's a very interesting dimension to it. In the Mahabharata, there was so much nonsense going on from the side of the Kauravas. So much misbehavior from all parties. The Pandavas were sent into exile for how many years? 16 years or whatever the number is. They seem to suffer because of their correct behavior. Whereas the other party were given prominence, given the kingdom for all this period of time. Now, is there any hint in the Mahabharata that Krishna approved of the behavior of the Kauravas? No. He constantly spoke against it. He even spoke directly to them about it and said that this is not very good. We should try and come to some arrangement. He tried to act as a mediator. He went to visit the Kauravas just before this whole thing happened and tried to come to some agreement so that this big mess didn't need to happen. So Krishna disapproved of so many things. He didn't approve of Duryodhana's conduct. He certainly didn't approve of the way Draupadi was treated. But did he sanction it? Yes. He did sanction it. Because not a blade of grass moves without Krishna's sanction. So that is a special dilemma that devotees have to process in their minds. Most people in many faiths, they have to process this concept. Why does God allow bad things to happen to good people? And that's been a cause of great difficulty. Practically any faith which does not understand the concept of karma and the concept of taking ownership for one's actions, which is practically all the faiths outside of the Vedic teachings, have a serious problem in explaining this fact. They come up with all sorts of diplomatic statements, all sorts of propaganda to try to keep the faithful faithful, even though they cannot explain this fundamental point. How is it that if God is all good and all he wants is good, how is it that there's bad things happening to all these people? Without this understanding of karma, without understanding God's law, without understanding God's desire, and also the sanction that God gives us to misbehave, without understanding this point also, we cannot really understand this concept properly. God does give us, and collectively, the chance to misbehave. And so in the Mahabharata, this discussion also took place when the question was raised as to how is it that persons are performing adharma, performing activities which are so incorrect, but it appears as if they are being supported and promoted and given facility, given opulence, given results. How come they appear to be flourishing, whereas those who follow dharma appear to be not flourishing? Well, one factor that was mentioned in the answer is that everything happens according to the will of the Lord. Bhishmadev says this as well. Nothing happens without the will of the Lord. And he mentions specifically the power of time, the time factor alone. But also, there is this point that Krishna does eventually correct situations, not according to our timescale. He does it at a timescale that suits him, at a time when he feels it is now correct for dharma to be established and correct followers of dharma to be given prominence. We just look through history. All nations, all cultures go through this. They start off with foundations. In America, you have founding fathers. They have principles, which are noble principles, initially. And initially, of course, most states, most countries were formed on the basis of spiritual authority. Whatever religion it was, that has been the overriding arbiter of the truth for that particular nation. Then as time has gone on, that has all become degraded. And different things are decreased, and most states are now practically atheistic. And so one's ability to follow dharma in society is also a highly evolving and changing thing as time goes on. So there are so many considerations here. As time goes on, different states, different empires rise and fall. And as time goes on, different persons gain prominence. Sometimes the saintly persons have prominence. At a certain point in the history, the priests had prominence. The Pope had prominence. The leaders of different faiths had prominence. Sometimes they don't. They are removed from their posts. Their post is made irrelevant due to secular ideologies. Someone else has more prominence. Now atheism is quite prominent. And now with artificial intelligence, Google is God. That is the next authority. And there are open discussions of how to have more decision-making made by automation, artificial intelligence, because it can take into consideration far more factors than any human being can. So it is useful, but not sufficient. That's the that's the problem for us. Useful, but not sufficient. And so as time goes on, we see a change. We see a change from saintly persons being in charge. We see a change from Krishna's rule being in charge to saintly persons carrying out his order. Now in the example of this Brahmana's son, to having others who are supposed to be carrying out Krishna's order, supposed to be standing up for the principles, but actually portray principles contrary to dharma. And so who has prominence is a highly time-based phenomenon. And it will change, and this is Kali Yuga, and this is the material world. So Krishna does not guarantee that at all times those who uphold dharma will be prominent. So never ever be fooled by who has prominence. That's my lesson from the class. Do not be fooled by whoever has prominence. At a certain point, someone will get prominence. Someone won't. The actual fact that we should be assessing is how is each person connecting themselves to the dharma of the Supreme Lord, the ultimate dharma. And then on a secondary basis, all the other upadharmas and all of the secondary principles and all of that. That is more important. Does a person rigidly, strongly accept the teachings? Now, a person may not be able to follow the teachings in their entirety. I mean, most of us, if we consider it, we would probably count a few deficiencies in our practice. In our practice, maybe in a gross way, we follow the principles, but perhaps we don't always in a subtle way. Now, any person could actually do an honest analysis of themselves and come up with many deficiencies in our practice of these principles. But at no point should we consider that our practice of the principles is the principle. That is the typical danger that arises. That because something appears too difficult according to Shastra, Prabhu, times have moved on. We don't do this anymore. You have to do this instead now. This culture that's described here is something arcane. Just ignore it. Just do what we want. That becomes a type of deviation. Okay, it's one thing to say, I don't understand this. I can't follow it. It's difficult for me to follow. It's another thing to say, okay, we don't need to follow it. Two things are so similar, but a world of difference between them. With one, you may accept an adjustment. You may accept some special case to be made for you so that you can advance. But you never ever consider that that special license that's been given to you only is the ultimate license or the standard. That's where all principles, all culture just disintegrates. And it just becomes a squabbling match of whoever can present their propaganda in the most enigmatic way to the right people at the right times, to whoever who has prominence, that will decide spiritual principles. Well, sadly, they should not be done like that. Spiritual principles should not be decided according to the whims of time. Spiritual principles remain substantial and unchanged. And anyone propagating change, propagating going with the times, propagating Prabhus, this is the 21st century, is perhaps not entirely representing, or perhaps not entirely fully qualified to represent Krishna and Prabhupada's teachings. So we can always bear these facts in mind. We all have so much work to do. So these things are mainly mentioned as items by which we can judge ourselves. Judge whether I am subtly going off a little. And ultimately, it is really meant for us. If each person considers all these wonderful examples that we've been given in Shastra, this example is given here of a saintly person of excellent culture, the junior serving the senior, and you have the unqualified offspring of an advanced person who are behaving in ways that do not suit them, do not befit their position. So these examples are all given to us, and we can look at those and we can consider, am I going down a similar path? We've been handed something very precious by Prabhupada. We don't need to adjust it. We don't need to modify it to go with the times. We don't need to do things that were not done before, just because it's now the norm or convenient to do so. We don't have to do that. If we follow Krishna's dharma, if we follow Krishna's laws, then that will prevail ultimately. Just when it does, not up to us. As I mentioned, the time scale is Krishna's time scale, and he does not go by our time scale. He does not say, okay, next year I'm going to correct this. Okay, 2 years, I'm giving you 2 years, you just tolerate the mess for 2 years, in 2 years' time it will be corrected. No, there'll be something more juicy coming in 2 years' time to worry about. This is the age of this is the age of juicy incidents and juicy opportunities assisted by the agents of Kali. So we have plenty to look forward to and plenty to worry about. But ultimately, ultimately all worry disappears when we surrender to Krishna. Sarva dharman parityaja mam ekam sharanam vraja. Aham tvam sarva papebhyo moksha ishami masuchaha. Any pap, any inadvertent things we do by our non-performance of some technical detail, if our full focus is to serve Krishna, he will deliver us from those discrepancies. So I'll stop there. See if there's any questions, comments, corrections.
Thank you, Prabhuji. Very nice connections and connections with the verse and everything. Just amazing. And I have a fine to understand how to be truthful and straightforward, but not insultive and not doing aparads. Oh, who yes. can be straightforward? Who cannot be straightforward? Mm. How to deal with this?
Yes, this is a great trick. This is the great mystery, and many incidents can be inflamed by not dealing with this correctly. There are three things that we're supposed to employ in communication: satyam, priyam, hitam, whether something is truthful, pleasing, and beneficial. Those are three considerations to apply in all dealings, really. Of those, truthfulness is the most important. It is a fact. That is the most important. For the sake of truthfulness, one should be prepared to compromise how pleasing something is. Also, well, actually, you know, beneficial is really the... You know, when you start to put these into hierarchies, you could come up with arguments that promote any of the hierarchies is correct. But really, it has to be for ultimate benefit. And so truth, yes, truth in... It's very rare that benefit and truth contradict. That's the point I made earlier in the class. It is a very, very rare circumstance where for someone's benefit, one has to compromise truth. It's only in these isolated incidents, like we read about here with Ashwatthama and with Krishna and killing the Kauravas and things like that, that these conflicts come about. Otherwise, practically, truthfulness and beneficial go together. So we have to bear these three things in mind. And now, the thing is, it depends who you're talking to as well, and also where you're situated. If you're speaking to someone who is not particularly Brahminically inclined, by their behavior you can see that they are more adept at wheeling and dealing rather than truthful conduct, then if you give them the absolute truth, it will probably backfire. Because when a person who doesn't want to hear the truth is told the truth, they normally get angry. That's normally the way it goes. They prefer something which is something that just makes them feel good. The truthfulness is a secondary characteristic. Oh, he said something nice to me, I feel good now. Maybe what he said wasn't actually correct, and maybe your true friend is the friend who tells you what you need to hear, not what just pleases you for the time being. So you have to consider who you're speaking to, their level. And you also consider your level. Then there are also considerations of junior, senior. That's also a factor. Now, typically, a junior person would not speak against a senior person, even if the senior person appears to be going against some conduct, truthfulness, etc. Generally, that's the rule. But there are exceptions. And Prabhupada demonstrates some exceptions. There was once these two persons who came to stay at the temple. And they were essentially just lazing around all day, not doing anything. They were sannyasis. And disciples were naturally serving them very nicely. And then they mentioned to Prabhupada that actually these two don't do anything at all. Prabhupada said, get rid of them, chuck them out. Now, normally, according to the etiquette of senior, junior, you wouldn't do that. But here is an occasion where there is so much nonsense going on in Kali Yuga, so that the position of senior, which is a respected, exalted position, has been, what's the word? It's been usurped. Usurped by others who do not fit that standard. And simply based upon their seniority alone, they expect respect. It's a thing to demand respect and to command respect. You know, that's the thing we hear. And so sometimes there are other occasions also. In this whole episode when Draupadi was being disrobed, mistreated, the Pandavas were being abused, it was not correct for her to speak in that assembly. But she did. There's something exceptional going on. All the seniors were there. Bhishmadev was there. The Acharyas were there. Dronacharya was there. Persons who were supposed to be ambassadors of real religious principles. And they were saying nothing. So she spoke. Conventionally inappropriate, but there was a circumstance and a need to do so. Krishna ultimately appreciated the side that she was on. And even though Bhishmadev was an exalted devotee, it is said very clearly, Prabhupada writes in a purport, that in connection with Bhishmadev's passing away, Prabhupada says, this episode of Bhishmadev passing away shows that one cannot be victorious if they go against the plan of the Lord, even if they are a devotee of the Lord. Bhishmadev was undoubtedly a great devotee of the Lord. He had the fortune of passing away with the Lord in his darshan. The Lord presented himself to Bhishmadev, and all the other Pandavas were brought there specifically for Bhishmadev's passing. But Prabhupada makes the point that Bhishmadev cannot be successful because he allowed this mistreatment to go on. So, in Kali Yuga, things especially are a little strange. And while the natural order is that seniors should be treated and respected, when there is inappropriate behavior from seniors, that does not have to be respected. Now, this is a very rare occasion, a very, very rare occurrence. We do not have to give due deference, due respect when someone is speaking against Krishna. Now, of course, there's so many examples in the scripture. Bali Maharaj, when his guru Shukracharya was trying to get him to do something which was contrary to religious principles, Bali Maharaj rejected Shukracharya, even though he owed his life to him. He rejected his words. There is a license. In some cases, when a person is highly inappropriately behaving, or if there is some gross misbehavior going on, inappropriate dealings, etc., it's very minor. There should practically never be an occasion where someone has to exercise that license. The natural order of things should definitely be that seniors are accepted with due deference, just as in this example here. So you have to take into account all these things. And I've just mentioned a few cases where the issue becomes murky. You know, do you truthfully act with this person? Do you say something pleasing to this person even when actually something truthful needs to happen? The person needs to be told they're, what they're doing is nonsense. Do you still just try to pacify them? These are dynamics. These are things to learn through the lesson of life, and preferably through association with advanced devotees. That's how we get more of a sense. Because neither the scripture nor any type of message or recipe that's been given to us is sufficient to deal with every problem. Some people say, just answers all in Prabhupada's books. And which bit should we open, please? Tell me. Which chapter, which verse? You can read one chapter and there'll be an example which suggests one course of action. You go to another canto, another part where a different type of action is endorsed. Which one do you follow? Sometimes Krishna tells the devotees to do something which he doesn't actually want to happen, because he wants the devotee to override him. That happens also, because Krishna tries to preserve the truth of his devotee even more than his own truth. So it's such a big subject. But I think those three things are a good way to navigate the issue. Maybe any more questions? So we have, yes, both of you.
Hare Krishna, thank you for the wonderful class. I was wondering if you could expand on how untruthfulness and lying in general, what effect that has on our consciousness, and if it occurs any sort of karmic reaction, therefore binding us more to the material world.
Yeah, that's very interesting. In the past, if someone even thought in their mind, they thought something untruthful or thought a lie, they would consider themselves highly contaminated. And they would undergo purification, different things to rid themselves of the sin they have committed just in the mind. Anyway, there are examples, but just in this pastime earlier in the previous chapter, we were hearing of this wonderful pastime, Kshir Chor Gopinath, right, where Madhavendra Puri just thought for a moment about the sweet rice. And he was thinking, this is a great sin that I've done. And he was highly regretful of it, lamenting. In his meditation, he was thinking, what a low person I am that I tried to think of enjoying the Lord's Maha. But then the Lord came and pacified it all. So a person, based upon their thought, if they're pure enough, just a thought alone is a cause of great concern to them. In Kali Yuga, there's a license, I think, that it happened in this incident with Yudhishthira and in the Mahabharata, that a sinful activity is not counted as sin unless it is actually performed. It's mentioned in the Bhagavatam, actually. In Kali Yuga, there is that thing, that until the activity itself is performed, it is not considered sinful, because we would be finished. We would be finished right at the beginning. There's no way we would get past step one, you know? So, but what it does to the consciousness is an interesting question. Because when someone develops a mentality of not being truthful, typically it means they're going to be more and more distant from the absolute truth. You were trying to follow Krishna, the absolute truth. And so a kind of a corroboree of that, or a related factor with that, is truthful dealings. So when we compromise truth, and as I mentioned, you only really need to compromise truth if you're doing something which is adharmic. Very, very rarely do you compromise the truth for dharmic reasons. You don't. So typically when you're trying to compromise the truth, it's because there's something adharmic that you're trying to do. So how can that be uplifting? That itself is just a cause of downfall. So it also develops, and the more you do it, the more habituated you become. And when you find that, okay, I've resolved this incident by a little dose of untruth, well, that was quite effective. Let me try it again for the next incident. Eventually, it just becomes just the norm, because typically it's easier. You know, when you try to keep a vow, it's harder than not keeping a vow. It's far easier to not keep the vow and create some propaganda to show people that you're keeping the vow. Right? It's much more difficult to actually follow the vow. So you have all these elements that sooner or later, that mentality, even if it does not directly produce a reaction at that moment, leads to a path of substantial degradation, which inevitably results in fall down. So it is really to be avoided. A kshatriya is meant to give up his life if he cannot keep his word. But what do kshatriyas promote? They promote saying anything and everything that suits their agenda. Sometimes, often Krishna jumps in to save the day when one of his devotees, like Arjun, has made a promise he can't keep. You know, you might remember the example of the brahmanas and the brahmanas' sons. Each time the brahmanas' wife gave birth to a child, it would die. And so eventually this brahmana said, okay, look, you're the king. He came to Arjun, he came to the court and said, what's going on here? You're in charge, it's your fault. If my wife's sons are dying, it's because there's some irregularity in the kingdom and you're the king, so you sort it out. So Arjun said, okay, if I do not manage to sort out this problem, I will enter into fire or I will end my life if I'm not able to bring back the brahmana's sons. So Krishna knows there's no way Arjun's going to do this on his own. So then Krishna jumps in and they have a whole pastime. They go west, they travel through darkness, they find all these sons and they deal with the issue. And it all turns out to be one big pastime. But Krishna goes out of his way to protect the truthful statements of his devotees. So if devotees are accustomed to the truth, like Arjun is, and Yudhishthira is, then if there is a circumstance which will compromise their truthful dealings, Krishna will override it. He will ensure that it's preserved, even at the cost of his own reputation. So that's ideally the state we're trying to get to, that our dealings are transparent and truthful so that we're pleasing to Krishna. Thank you. Yeah, I think Ian was next. Yeah. And then Gopinath.
Hi, Krishna. Thank you so much for your class. I had a question. As you were talking about, how we should kind of like stick to what's been set and let the rest be organized by the Lord's mercy. In a matter of preaching, like when we're trying to kind of like get out to people and we see ourselves kind of trying to manipulate and work things out to get the best result. So my question was, how do we know when is the right time for us to like kind of take a chill and not experiment too much and leave it to the Lord's mercy? Or what's that cutting point where we shouldn't keep on like trying to change because we're always trying to evolve and change things to like, get the best result numbers-wise. Yeah.
Well, the preacher does have a certain license to portray the movement, the principles, in measured doses. You know, give the right dose of the right medicine to the person who can take it. So there is a very deep consideration there as to what you say to someone, and for what do you say to which type of person, and that's not considered untruthful. That is considered a part of the progress of making that person receptive and making that person accept and respect the Lord. So when you say change, I mean, we might have many plans. We might innovate different types of preaching. Different places have had great success with innovative types of preaching. Preaching in different places works. As long as the principles are not compromised, different standards, different styles, different groups of people are receptive. If you can give a very scientific presentation of Krishna consciousness to a person who is scientifically inclined, then that can be very, very effective. For someone else, it might not be so effective. But that doesn't mean you've deviated by using scientific terms. Prabhupada wanted that to happen. He set up the BI so that the scientists would be spoken to in a language which they could appreciate. Typically, when I listen to devotees talking about science, I cringe. You know, with a scientific background, and some of the things they say are just so off the scientific platform and do not even come up to the standard rigor that scientists themselves employ in assessing their own words, that I think this is not conducive. So you need people who can actually speak our philosophy with proper scientific substance, and that's effective for some people. So we may have to try all sorts of things, but the principle should never be compromised. If we promote something that isn't correct and promote it as something that should be done, then that's probably where you are getting into the line, you know? You're asking, where is the line between, is this too much innovation or is this... It's always nice to innovate how to preach. It's very much desired. The resources, the materials, the tools, the internet is a right platform for preaching right now. It's perhaps the only platform which is functional at the moment in a large scale. It's certainly the platform that has grabbed practically every single person on the planet. So if we ignore it, that's not sensible. You know, Prabhupada, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj wanted books published because books were the item of value for the educated people. And the educated people were reading other books which were containing nonsense, effectively. And so to get to them, you need to produce books which will be given a sense of legitimacy by them. So that's the lineage, the history of books, specifically. Otherwise, books have only existed the last few hundred years. There's no mass distribution of books before Srinivas Acharya and those times. So the method changes. But the internet is now something that everyone is hooked onto. Everyone, whether they're a saint or a sinner, they're on the internet. So our preaching must be through that forum as well. And so we have to do so many things, creatively do things. Try something that works. If it doesn't work, try something else. There's so many things that we can do. And we just have to be true to Krishna and he'll guide us. Okay. Gopinath Prabhu?
Thank you for the really nice class. I was just wondering, it's a bit different than the topic we're discussing. In the purport, Prabhupada mentions that the son of the Brahmana was a typical idol worshipper and also mentions atheist. I struggle sometimes to understand this concept. How could people worship idols unless they have some faith or belief maybe that this is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, or at least a great personality, a great being is present within that idol, the deity. So I don't understand how people actually do idol worship unless they have some faith that there's a person present in there. Doesn't make much sense to me.
Yeah, well, that's probably the best way to leave it, that it doesn't make much sense. It's very good it doesn't make sense to you. It's more of a worry if it does make sense. But the way they rationalize it, and if you look at the followers in the, see the Shankaracharya line, the Mayavadis, they worship five deities. You know, Ganesh and there's a few others, Durga Devi, and there's five deities that they worship. And the aim is that eventually through the worship of these deities, they will realize that they are the deity, or that they'll realize that they're God. So the authorities or the items which are considered sacred, they do consider them sacred and they'll do all sorts of murti-type things with them. They are tools to allow you to achieve a higher goal. So it's a similar kind of mentality as sort of Buddhism, a little bit, whereby they don't accept the objects, the deity so much, but they see them as a means of focusing your attention so that you can be situated in a higher state of meditation in the future. Muslims also, the Kaaba, is it called the Kaaba? The big stone in Mecca. They don't consider that stone itself to be particularly worshipable or anything like that. And inside, actually, I watched a documentary once, it's hollow inside. They take dignitaries inside and sit down. But it is a central focal point. That's the priority of it. So sometimes, because people know that they are materially, they're in this material body, and they're dealing with something that's spiritual, but it has to have some material connection, otherwise they just can't move forward. So then they may take a material object, they may deify it, they may do something more sort of spiritual with it, but at the end of it, they don't really treat it with much respect in that sense. So that's, many cultures do that type of thing. Now for us, when Srila Prabhupada, or an advanced devotee, has welcomed the Supreme Lord, that deity is definitely not wood or marble anymore. That deity is Krishna. That's the Supreme Lord directly. So we have a different twist on it. This is not simply a tool for us to get somewhere. It is not it is not just a nice pretty object that gives us some entertainment in the mornings and people go wow and produce photos. No. This is Krishna himself. He's here with his divine consort. And we serve them in a way that pleases them, hopefully. And we are directly serving Krishna. So Krishna is manifested in this beautiful form for us right now, based upon the limitations of our senses. How merciful is he? That doesn't detract from his position as Krishna. So that is the difference between, for instance, devotees. And every devotee here, every neophyte devotee is on a much higher platform than the son of this Brahmana. Just by the mentality that he has. Even a person who's just come into the movement is just sincerely trying to find out about Krishna and has some respect for the deity form of Krishna is on a much higher level than this. So that's idol. That's how through contamination one starts to see the deity as an idol. Okay. Ladies, yes, Kishori, do you want to give her the mic?
Hi, Krishna Prabhu. I was wondering, if we do see the deity as stone or wood, and we do, you know, we see the deity in that way, what can we do to help improve our consciousness, and how can we actually begin to see the deity as Krishna himself?
Yeah, you might have to wait till Krishna gives you that. Because one can only understand Krishna by his mercy. One can understand me only as I am by pure devotional service, he says in the Gita. So the more service we render to Krishna with more and more purity, and the more we theoretically accept it also. There's something interesting in the Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada says that in the beginning, as we approach the Bhagavad Gita, we should at least theoretically accept that Krishna is the Supreme Lord and that Arjuna is his dear devotee. At that point, you know, when you initially approach, you don't know anything. You can't say for sure that Krishna is the Supreme Lord. You barely know anything. At least theoretically accept it. Why? Because Asita, Devalo, Vyasa, Swayam Chaiva, Bravishime, that all these other great saintly persons have corroborated that this is Krishna. So at least you theoretically accept it. Then as time goes on, as we render more devotional service, as we read more of the Gita, it starts to make more and more sense. And then there may be even some direct interactions with Krishna. And those will always give a person extra potency. So at least we can look around and we can see that there are many, many people. We'll start with our founder Acharya, who had such great reverence and worship for the deities. So much concentration and great ecstasy he had. If you remember in those pictures when he was offering the first arti to Radha Gokulananda. Such concentration, such focus, such grace. There's no doubt that here is a person who is entirely seeing this is Krishna. So you have Prabhupada, you have so many advanced devotees in the movement who genuinely do have a very deep connection with Krishna. And you can talk to them also. When we meet, you know, say Jananivas Prabhu, Pankajangri Prabhu from Mayapur, so many others, each temple has unique, special pujaris, you know, who have a very, very close, intimate connection with the Lord. When we talk to them, we get a sense of their Lord. And that is That is where the Lord is. He's actually with them in their consciousness. So the more we do that, then Krishna over time, he makes his presence known to us. He allows us to see behaviors which are quite different to stone and wood. He interacts with us in ways that there's no doubt in our mind that Krishna is a person. And so it's time is one of the is one of the separating factors. That's all, only time. But it will definitely come if we want it. Thank you. Okay. Shri Chaitanya Charitamrita ki, Srila Prabhupada ki.